Welcome to a Podcast on Fire Network bonus episode 20 called The General Sum 2 and 3. And this is a website exclusive bonus episode that works as extra filler, added bonus, added perspective on the main discussion in What's Korean Cinema episode 14, where we talked of In Context, The General's Son in the first half. And also, as you might remember, this story of gangster Kim Do-han turned politician. Kim Do-han was made into a trilogy by the director. And the remaining two movies we're going to review in this bonus episode. And I'm going to be with me again is Hangul Celluloid's Paul Quinn. So say hi again, buddy.
Hello, guys.
And it's funny, we kind of, I don't know if you remember this, Paul, we can get this out of the bag, so to say, that we didn't record this straight after the main recording. This is several weeks later. So it's funny, we kind of assumed this trilogy would touch on his political life. It just kind of made sense. But having seen the entirety of Im Kwon-taek's take on it now, it never mentions that he's a politician in these movies. These are his gangster days only. So that is quite interesting. I did not expect that. So
I think it works. I think it works better for that as well.
I'm just curious, really, really curious. I mean, maybe another movie eventually will come out that, or it has come out already, I don't know, that touches on his career and politics. But for now, this is his gangster days as envisioned by Im Kwon-taek and Kim Do-han's main conflict with the Japanese Yakuza, I suppose, the Hayashi gang. So, but yeah, what's been up since you and I last talked? You've attended a two-week event of sorts, so, and it has an Im Kwon-taek connection, if you will. So I want to tell the listeners about what you've been doing.
London Korean Film Festival 2014, 14 days of screening, talk to people, screening. It's been fun.
That is a lot of time to give to an event. Like, kudos to London, I suppose, for giving the space, a two-week space for Korean movies. Not Asian movies, Korean movies.
You've really got to give them serious credit. I mean, they started, this is the ninth year, so it's been going for a while, but they started with 11 films the first year. And this year there were 55, you know, and okay, they weren't all packed out, but a fair few of them were. So kudos to them. And it was a good festival. It was a lot more diverse than last year. Still quite male-centric, you know, male directors, male actors. But that's just me as a dodgy old man thinking, I'll bring some pretty women over.
There's nothing dodgy about that. I mean, it's a good thing to acknowledge if you can bring over female talent or female production personnel and what have you. So that's not a dodgy thing. That's a healthy thing to think diversity is a good thing. But it's not at the same time you pouting about it and looking down on the festival.
Certainly not. And, you know, they had Anson Key over yesterday. I got to do a group interview with him.
That would be, for listeners, the silent assassin from Nowhere to Hide, the trench coat assassin, among other things. Obviously, I know him from that, and the only movie I know him from otherwise is Chilsu and Mansu.
You couldn't pick two better movies, let's be honest.
Really excellent movies. He's excellent in both. And post that episode on those two movies, I saw him in the, I suppose it's a co-production of sort, but he was in an Andy Lau movie called Battle of Wits.
He was indeed.
And acted against Andy Lau. It's not a sync sound movie, though, so they dubbed him into Mandarin, and he was not playing a Korean character. So,
you know, and for your listeners that are into non-Korean stuff as well, you know, it's worth checking out. I haven't transcribed it yet, but over the next couple of days, it's worth checking out that interview because he talks a fair bit about the non-Korean movies that he's been in and the difficulties he had, and it's a really interesting interview, so something for everybody to keep their eyes peeled for.
But the Im Kwon-taek connection, what is that in regards to this year's festival then?
Essentially, their closing gala was his 102nd movie.
Holy fucking Christ, that is a lot.
I know, wow. Which has got a really dodgy French title, the English version, called Revivre, Live Again. Which I don't think suits the film. But phenomenal film, obviously. Anson Key was starring in it, which is why he was there. I saw it for the first time last night. And I don't know about you, Ken, but when I'm reviewing stuff, I'll always put up what's coming, and I'll rarely change it, but the odd time you switch around, as soon as you see that, you think, you know what, I'm going to have to switch things around. And before we talked here tonight, I'm thinking, how do I make an excuse to say that the next thing I'm going to talk about is Revivre, because it's just, it's M. Quantec through and through. Astonishing film.
Excellent, and a full review obviously will come, and a lot of good-natured rants about it on social media, I'm sure, will come as well, as the ripples start, not just from you, but the cinema community as well, because I'm sure there's a lot of anticipation, as always. As we talked about in the main episode, M. Quantec is not this old fogey that no one cares about anymore. Quite the opposite, you know.
Right, exactly. You know, before the screening, they had... He's not very well, I have to say, so he couldn't come over. He had wanted to, but they filmed a little bit with him just saying, hi, sorry, I can't be there. And again, just such an utter humble gentleman, and you could actually see he looks a bit under the weather, and you just think, you poor geezer, you know, 102nd movie, let's hope you get well and make your 103rd, 4th, 5th, 6th.
Right on. So let's dive into it then. The content for this bonus episode is The General's Son 2 and 3. And we start with The General's Son 2 from 1991. First one was in 1990. Here's the middle one. And the third one was 1992. So they were released that way. And plot from moderncoreancinema.com. It goes as follows. Our hero Kim Do-han, played by Park Sang-min, is released from prison in the Mapo-gu district of Seoul by the short, mustached Korean detective who seems to have it out for him. The only difference between this and the last installment's opening is that instead of being a poor kid living under a bridge, released with nothing and facing an uncertain future, now he is a gang boss and he is welcomed by his minions and the citizens of his neighborhood. He is adored by all, a foreshadowing of his successful later life in politics. So there's like a hint of his history in politics there, that he apparently was a successful politician and a liked politician. So again, I would have liked to hear from that it can, in my feeble head, Paul, it made sense that maybe the first two are his gangster life and like the final 2 hours, the third one, is the politician's life. But hey, I'm not really complaining. I was just kind of anticipating it, that I'd like to see that, if Park Sang-min can pull off the older routine, because I assume that would have been him too all the way through. They would not have switched actors, but hey, it's just wishful thinking from my perspective,
I guess. And I do have thoughts on why M. Quantec chose to do what he did, but we'll talk about those a little bit later.
But anyway, my short opinion, first of all, I possibly will make kind of the same statement for part three. But anyway, part one is so strong because of the introduction to Do-han and the environment. And it's nice to see it continued in part two, this life. And also nice to see it in part three as well, because I see part two and three as one whole movie, actually. It really feels like they chopped them up for commercial reasons, that it should be more easily digestible if we chopped them up. But interest does slip a little bit in terms of character relationships, and you're never truly blown away, but it's a solid follow-up story-wise, and technically, M. Quantec continues to impress. So that's the theme kind of from the first movie that we talked about. So that's my short opinion for now. What do you think of part two?
I love part two. I love part three. I love part one. On its own, part one is exactly as you said. It's so explosive. It's so striking that you just think, wow. When I watched it on its own before I'd seen two and three, there was a part of me that thought, that's great, but it's not M. Quantec as I know him. Because through his whole career, he's constantly talked about feminism the whole way through. He's obsessed with it. As you all know, I was part of a group interview with him about a year ago, and I focused on that because I'm obsessed with women in Korean cinema. And he not only answered my question, but he went on and on, and he mentioned film after film after film, specifically saying, this is feminism, this is, you know, misogynism, this is blah, blah, blah. And that, for me, in hindsight, after watching number one, I thought, where's the feminism? They're all the girls are just girls. And for me, two and three brings the other aspects in. So for different reasons, they struck me as strongly as the first one did. I love them. And as you say, I think one, two, and three together makes a Korean film, an archetypal Korean film. Each on their own has elements, but together they should be together. And if you've seen one, you really, really need to see two and three.
Yeah, I suppose you can go into part two sans part one if worst comes to worst. If you have a summary of part one that you can catch up to part two. With part three, you can't. You need to have part two because it opens mid events, like it was just turned a page, so to say. But anyway, Park Sang-min in the lead role, his transformation is something I like throughout the trilogy, and that's the physical transformation as well as the character transformation. You know, going from, you know, little snotty spotty kid to hailed and respected and going transforming into a man. He's a young looking actor, but it's still quite convincing. And I liked it more when Im Kwon-taek focused on the fact that he has a streak of irrationality in him. It yes. seems for a while he's quite perfect. He's so liked. And he speaks in a deliberate way and does the right thing. But throughout these movies, especially when it concerns women, you know, the kid comes out, the irrationality comes out. And that fits Park Sang-min a lot.
It really does, yeah.
I don't think he's supposed to be super, super old in parts two and three. He's still kind of wet behind the ears, so to say. And he's got good instincts as a character. And is doing really well, and he's liked by his people. But it is that streak of irrationality that I think remains one of my fondest memories of watching him in these movies, this character arc, if you will. So I don't know. How do you think he does? You know, how do you think he does Park Sang-min throughout the trilogy?
I think he's phenomenal. You know, he is one of the. There are a lot of strong points about all of the films, but he is. He is the cement that holds it together. And as you say, that irrationality works really well. I also saw it as almost a shadow of the little punk that's still inside him, even though he is a boss, a grown individual who's suddenly lauded by everybody. He still has little points where he turns into that, you know, teenage kid ready yeah. to explode and kick ass because he's a bit pissed off. And admittedly, as you say, in two and three, most of his being pissed off is either a hatred of the Japanese or a woman, which brings us back to that whole Im Kwon-taek and his women thing.
Because it is totally the male that is being made to look worse here. Obviously, just shouting for no reason, really. And yeah. women are the voice of reason, if you will.
Very much so.
Part two continues looking calm, technically, when we're talking context, you know, style, working with the cinematographer. It's a slick and vibrant cinematography that is a staple of these movies, and I'm sure many of his movies, that it doesn't need to move around and be active for us to be actively involved, you know what I mean? Im Kwon-taek is not going to draw attention to himself by starting the shot in fucking space and yeah. then end up on a close shot of Kim Do-han eating his noodles just because it'll look cool, man. You know, he's too mature for that. So, you know, but having said that, has he, you know, he's had his stages of his career. So I'm sure he's been a lot more stylish in other movies than he is here.
Very, very much so. And in his, a lot of his other movies, the surroundings, the beauty of Korea, if you like, becomes a huge play that he takes in, that he goes across. I mean, Sopyeonje comes straight to mind. Mm-hmm. And that isn't the case here. In two and three, his framing, his camera setup in terms of the fights and stuff is pretty much as it was in one, but It's been a while now since I watched one, but all I could think when I was rewatching two and three was these fight scenes start far, far more explosively. They go from nothing to bang. Whereas the very first one, there was a lot of I'm standing here with my fists up and we're about to fight.
A little bit more of the Chambara Japanese style in that first one. Yeah, definitely. The drumming up of tension a little bit.
You know, and I think that the explosive nature of 2 and 3 almost negates the need for M'Quantech to do anything else. He can be understated, and it still goes, you know, from nothing to, like, the guy who's having his money taken. I can't actually remember if it's 2 or 3, but having his money taken, and he's just like, I need my money. And then, bang, he's kicked their asses, and in 2 minutes, they're lying on the floor. You think... I don't remember it being that explosive in number one, and I think
you're right. It's a far more violent and brutal two movies. These ones, because the violence is escalated in the conflict anyway. So it's that it's quite something I'm fond of, that Dohan is this calm character, except when it comes to the fighting. So he's not this throughout this Joe Pesci Goodfellas, like owning the fucking room and just wailing on everybody and just bam, 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 fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. You know, he's explosive when he needs to. It's almost like he just transforms when he becomes a fighter, because it's not his character, this macho, buffed up, muscular, opposing dude. It does not look very opposing, which is something that is quite fun. That it's not forced that he is a good fighter. It's just that he isn't. It's kind of sneaky, if you will, that he's got this power in him. But his good nature and fair and dedicated to his people. Otherwise, you know, this all has not gotten to his head that I'm the best fighter. You know, give me money and bitches, baby. You know, he's not that kid, really, in terms of that. But I guess because there's not too much trouble and bloodshed yet, that parts of two still has him quite rational, you know what I mean? And the rationality, I think, happens a lot more the more trouble and more escalated bloodshed happens throughout the movie, which kind of makes sense. He's not walking on steady ground anymore, the character. He's going to face challenges, if you will.
Very much so. And from my point of view, the calm, collected, the nice guy, the almost sly smile as he walks past people and they tap him on the shoulder, warmed me to him a lot more than if he had been, you know, the hard-ass guy, which some of the other characters are, and they're just caricatures. They're just, it works a lot more for me. And again, it brings in that whole, the link to the woman thing. You can see why he's sought after by every woman that comes into his path. They're all just ready to drop for him. And it's because he's essentially a cool guy.
His facial expressions at times can look a little bit overdone. It's a smirk, if you will, but he continues that transition into leader role very well. You know, he's got gravitas and presence, the character. He's not thoroughly a kid. That kid comes out, as we said, but he's not thoroughly a kid. Park Sang-min, I've not looked into this gentleman's background. He looks to be martial arts able, or he trained very well for the film, because his kicking skills...
phenomenal.
Really, really good. Have you heard anything if he has some martial arts background? Or
nothing at all. I mean, the thing about Park Sang-min is his career has been so tiny. It's not a mystery, but it's just, well, where did he go and how did he get where he was? He was in a film called Tube, which was, violent, street fighty, but there was no martial arts whatsoever. Then he did this, and it just seems like he's been, you know, doing it for years. Where he got it from, I have absolutely no idea. And as I say, he sort of disappeared off the face of the acting earth. So he certainly didn't carry it on for a long time.
He's, I mean, Korea has made martial arts action movies, so it's not like they have to turn to Hong Kong to even hire a choreographer. So I'm sure someone really talented came in and choreographed this and did it really well. These action scenes still come off very well. You know, one of the initial ones in two is an attack in, I believe, Kim Do-han's bedroom. So he has to go into attack mode. And it's this quite close quarter excitement that still comes off as fluid, despite being very chaotic, and there's even a handheld camera to capture this. And yet, despite being shaky, it's still miles away from the shaky and handheld poison that we have in today's industry. You know what I mean? That it's still clear, and some of that, a lot of that even must come from in Quantech that, okay, we got handheld here, but make sure it's fucking visible, dude. And editing certainly plays a part in this too, that there should not be these hyperactive edits either. And I suppose this is the time where this could be captured well, and a decade later we were into someone, I think Tom on another show, one of my co-hosts, said that possibly Saving Private Ryan kickstarted this in a good way, but then he kind of derailed after that. But I'm not sure exactly what the starting point was for the MTV editing to come in here, because I'm sure if The General Sun would have been made today, we would have seen some of that, and it would be like, what's going on? Can't say anything.
Yeah, totally. And the fact that it's not like that, almost in hindsight again, makes you appreciate it more. I mean, some of those fight scenes are amazing. Some of those hits, his angles are so perfect. You know, I was rewinding to see if I could see them not hitting, and you think that actually really looks like it's connecting. I mean, perfectly. It has been said, I mean, that interview yesterday with Aung San Ki, he made a point of saying that Im Quantech never decides what he's going to do before the time. He never tells his actors what he's going to do before the time.
Really?
And I'm assuming because of the fight scenes, obviously they were choreographed, they were said that they were going to have this fight scene, but I assume Im Quantech's come in and decided on the spot that that's his framing, that's his handheld, that's the way it's going to be done. Bang, one take, done. That's the way it sounds to me. How he managed that is probably why he's one of the greatest directors in the world, because the thought just, it almost sends shivers up your spine.
He's got a good vision for it, because there is history of directors thinking they're good enough to choreograph action too. And it's failed miserably, where they should have left it up to the actual talent that knows angles and editing. But you know, he's a craftsman to the extent that he can work very well with a choreographer, I'm sure, and not get in the way of the visions. And it certainly comes off so very effortlessly, these fight scenes. And the enhanced brutality of them is something I quite enjoy, because it seems so, the movie, the first one, comes off as more mild-mannered. There's not a huge amount of battles and bloodshed, and this one really takes it up, and it has a bit of a nasty streak, I do have to say. Having said all of that about that, you don't need one. In reality, yeah, it certainly does not hurt, because it's a good movie. But what In Quantech does not do here is it doesn't flash back to the first one at the top of this one. There's no exposition dumps about what went on in the first one. It just kind of trucks forward. You know, you recognize characters that come back. You certainly connect to a lot of the new ones that comes in here. And I think it's a valid choice to not worry about tracking back to one in the movie. You know what I mean?
I totally agree with you. And on the point that you made earlier on, that you could almost watch two without having watched one, I think that works doubly, because it starts in a perfect way. If you knew who Kim Do-han was and you hadn't seen one, you could still see right where he's come out of prison, obviously. He's a gang boss, so this is somewhere in his career, and then the story goes on. If you've seen one, you don't need a flashback, because you are, as you say, going to recognize the characters. You are going to know that when the first one ends with the policeman looking at him, the second one starts with him coming out of prison. You can sort of put two and two together. You don't need exposition. Exposition in Western movies drives me insane. It's part of what drove me to Korean cinema in the first place. So the fact that it doesn't use it, for me, is a huge bonus.
Yeah, exposition dumps is the really the very expression, and it's so damn hard. And in any cinema, I don't know if I know too much about Korean cinema where I can say they do it better compared to other ones, but certainly it's such a hard art, and sometimes filmmakers should have more confidence in themselves, and sometimes it's forced upon them, I'm sure, by other forces in a production. A little funny aside, we talked of in the main episode, I think Inquan Tech and crew created the movie that they watch in the movie, and I think it's the same here, because Kim Do-han goes with the Japanese geisha, goes to a movie, and it looks like a recreation of something Akira Kurosawa-ish. It looks too crisp to be something that an actual movie, you know what I mean? So I think they created a little bit of Chambara cinema, for black and white Chambara cinema, in The General Sun 2.
I totally agree with you, and I didn't have a lot of time, but I did search about to see if I could find if it was a film that had been used, and there's no word at all, so I'm assuming they've created specifically for that scene with the two of them sitting in the cinema and him, you know, having seen the film eight times or whatever he says.
Yeah, because she asks if he's bored, because he's yawning. That's, though, a character of a Japanese geisha, and maybe I wasn't paying attention. Because it happens, you know, because I do like my pornography and my ninja movies, so my attention isn't needed at all times, okay?
Good for you. Good for you.
But that geisha character, I felt she was so firmly established that I think she kind of fell to the wayside in the storytelling, because she was, as she was introduced and Kim Do-han started to socialize a little bit more with her, that's obviously a sign of conflicted interests, at least, yeah, in terms of what his gang sees that as. You know, she's half Japanese, she's still trouble, you know, and one even says, like, now it's not the time to play with a Jap's bitch, quote.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? But I don't know, she kind of fell to the wayside, and that's why, you know, I like this better than Free, I can tell you that much, but it's sort of something that I missed a follow through on, you know what I mean? But maybe I just lost attention.
I don't think you did. I think, and this is just my opinion, and if Rufus was here, I'm sure he'd stand up and
he'd say,
go,
no, you're wrong.
No, hold on, man.
Because we're critics like that. We look down on each other and say, you're wrong, and that's our constructive discussion.
That's what we have to do. But, you know, and as this occurred to me as I was watching the film, you think, you might be wrong here, Paul, you really might, but it occurred to me, so I'm going to tell you anyway. The whole him being with a half Korean, half Japanese girl, yeah, she's still, as one of them says, a Jap bitch or whatever. That does sort of give you your conflict, whatever else. But in terms of, from my point of view, Korean cinema, the whole thing about Korean cinema is you've got your first section with the build-up and who the characters are, the violence, the action, and then it switches into the love and loss. And there's always endless love and loss, and it's got to be Korean. And in the second one, the main female character, Chae-won, I think her name is the one who leaves him going to drink, getting drunk, and then taking on generals because he's lost his girl. And she has to be Korean, and from that point of view, the Japanese girl really has to step aside because it's got to be proper Korean love and loss. That's just my opinion, but you know, if the Japanese girl had carried on, I would have felt a little bit, hold on, this is not Korean cinema as I want it, and that's me being an arse about it. But it's true; it's got to be a Korean man, a Korean woman, and the Korean girl being taken away from him and leaving him with nowhere to turn, if you like. And that pushes him towards his first big fight with those generals.
Which can be I can certainly understand it. It can also be, if it's used so frequently, that structure, it can also be a lazy tool if you're the wrong filmmaker, I suppose. Because you don't want things to be predictable. Like 3-2-1, there's the thing I know from those many movies, you know.
Totally, and I'm sure it's the same in, there are issues in Japanese, Chinese stuff that you watch a lot more than me, But I can tell you, you know, I watched a 2014 film, a 2013 film, one, two nights ago, where you think, you check your watch because you think, right, that's that bit done, and they're starting to do the lost bit, so it must be about an hour and 5 minutes. You look at your watch, and it's, oh, it's an hour. There's 11 lost bit, and then the melodrama sets in. And I love Korean cinema, but there is a lot of it, and there is a lot of predictability out of laziness, out of big companies having too much control and forcing it into, this is classic, rather than letting filmmakers do what filmmakers do.
Right. Well, I appreciate the perspective. So certainly, it's not something I know at all, and it's sort of something I can keep an eye out for as I try and explore.
Keep your watch on. You check after an hour.
Gotcha. And to track back a little bit to something that I am fond of is the fact that Kim Do-han is, his Jong-ro or Jong-lo gang is, seems to be controlling this fairly rural area, right? It's not this bustling metropolis. And they still, him included, wear these expensive suits, and they stand out. And it doesn't ring false with the people here. It might, when you look at it as a viewer, that just seems kind of cocky, doesn't it? But it doesn't ring false with the people. They adore him, and I suppose this is a non-thing, as a matter of fact. It's nothing to get hung up on that he's all of a sudden better or anything. It's just a curious visual in a way, where you look like, hey, is he kind of just being too cocky for by being a boss now? But no, it's just a natural thing, you know. And I enjoy that. It's a little side note, if you will, that you either catch or you don't, that I actually enjoy, because no one makes any fuss about it in dialogue anyway in the movie. They just dress like this. They dress like snappy gangsters.
Very much so. And you can tell them a mile off. There are a couple of things that hit me with that, again, both in 2 and 3. And I know we're jumping over a little bit, but you know, there's a point where he goes and sees a load of people who are covered in mud, no food, and he's still got his suit on, and he's just accepted. And there's another thing where they go to infiltrate Japanese, and they're all disguised as Japanese with all the, you know, robes, whatever you have, and they've still got their gangster hats on, and you just go, what? And it's just accepted. They get past all the, you know, the people they're meant to get past because they've got the robes on. You think, but they've got the hats on. They're the Jung-Lo gang. You know what I mean? It actually made me giggle. It brought a smile to my face, which you sort of need in the midst of fights and love and loss and everything else.
But having said that, all about bloodshed and what have you, one aspect that I really dig is the fact that Kim Do-han is kind of rebuilding the gang at one point and fighting a lot of people, but it's this code in even this gangster world, where obviously there's access to weapons, that the fighting is what decides it all. But it's not about a fight to the death kind of thing here. Whoever wins, you know, that's the one who has the advantage, who can kind of move forward. And I like this decision making, that it's not it is who wins the fight, but not who comes out alive at the fight, out of the fight. And this strong sense of honor and defeat can of course be crippling to a character who loses. But even I believe it's the character, one of the earliest scenes of the character Dong Hae Kim, that he defeats. In a scene later, he drinks with him at the bar, at the hostess' house, if you will. And Dong Ha is crushed and distraught, and obviously is not in a party mood at all, because that was not an honorable thing to have gone through, especially because he's more on the Japanese side at that point, too. So he's obviously going to have to go report back that he was defeated, and he was expected to win. So it's not all about bloodshed at this point. 3 really ramps it up, because it just comes to that point where it turns into vicious murder and killing. So, you know, gone is the honor, you know what I mean? It's not, free is not settled with a fight, necessarily. It's settled through violence. And it's a good streak of the movie, a good philosophy of the movie, and I'm sure it's true to a Korean gangster life of that time. I don't think this is necessarily manufactured.
I agree with you. Again, maybe it's me reading too much, Jim, but if you look at I think it's the first big fight between the big group of Japanese and the big group of Korean gangsters. All the Japanese have swords. All the Japanese are ready to kill. If you look at what the Koreans have, they have sticks, they have mallets. One of them's got an axe, fair enough, but it's all a case of beating the Japanese to a pulp and leaving them, you know, on the floor, but not dead, whereas the Japanese are ready to kill. And I think that underlines the whole concept of what Kim Do-han is. He's the guy who will beat the oppression rather than murder. And the killing part is a big turning point for the whole film, as we both know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's bringing Koreans together. That's his aim, because this area, Jeonru, as the first movie established, that's not an area you can lose. It kind of contains a lot of Korean pride and soul. It's the sort of one of the last standing areas that the Japanese have not taken over. So I think the underlying thing there is that Kim Do-han is not maintaining it murder and killing. He's maintaining it through, you know, through being a fighter. And his relationships with Dong-hae Kim, the character, which they met as poor kids, and they went through some experiences that way, and he enters his life again. And it's a compelling character. I don't know the actor's name, unfortunately.
I can't say I do off the top of my head either.
He after his loss, he is questioning whether or not he can be saved. You know, if he's lost his Korean roots, if you will, and or if he's just this Japanese puppet that has no soul anymore. It's kind of touching in a very subtle way. You know, you remember the scene where Dong-hae Kim is walking through the market in Jeonru and seeing the activity and the joy of everyone in the market. So certain people, yeah. He's even cracking a smile. It's a nice established human moment in a very like conflicted character that's probably ultimately wants, you know, he's not mad at Korea, but yeah. He's made his choice at one point by working for the Hayashi gang, I suppose. But ultimately he opts not to, I mean, it's a minor spoiler, but whatever. He opts not to belong after he is defeated. You know, he wants to do something that isn't gang related at all. So it's an admirable stance to take rather than kill himself.
And I think his character's a big, big part of the whole story, a lot bigger than he appears early on, because it all heads towards the whole, if you're Korean, you're Korean. And that's what Kim Do-han stands for. You know, Koreans in the face of the Japanese, staying Korean, being able to stay Korean.
But what he's doing, I admire, and I hope that's true for the real life character too, that just because you ever so slightly walked away from being 100% Korean or anything, they don't exclude people as such. There's quite a lot of scenes where, not quite a lot of, there are scenes where Kim Do-han is trying to reel people in again and even create some understanding between the Japanese side and the Korean side, because I believe he has a meeting with that sort of, and even a fight maybe, with that sort of big burly Japanese fight instructor, and they kind of bond over martial arts and what have you. So he's not this pure Japanese hater or anything, Kim Do-han. It's there is this sort of subtle, not very outspoken theme of some understanding with some of the Japanese side, because all are not the black clad Hayashi gang, kill, kill, kill.
Totally.
You know, so that's a nice streak that you can pick up on, which is a character I appreciated in The General Son too, that there is some stuff there to be extracted, but it's not done through any, you know, voiceover or exposition dumps, that this is what I see and feel now, audience. Can you hear me? I shall repeat it.
Exactly. It's just there. if you want to pick up on it, and let's be honest, you're not going to miss it.
Yeah, it's Im Quantec is skilled enough to obviously just naturally convey it on screen, and you're kind of, hey, that's what he's doing. So it's not hidden in symbolism and abstract visuals or anything. No, not at all, not at all. And it kind of, you know, the end of my notes kind of here, I like the more we see Kim Do-han, who you thought was really sharp and well-developed at that point, the more frail emotionally he gets and more irrational he gets, especially when it comes to women, is a compelling gear of the movie, because it happens when kind of the first massacre, the most violence, also happens in the movie, kind of within the same reels anyway, that he's not on stable ground as a character, and the conflict, you know, John Rowe can fall, that is also on the table. And there's a lot of for this series, a lot of brutal extended violence, you know, beatings and some, you know, killings by sword or what have you. But the beatings are what really stands out. There's quite a lot of almost, I wouldn't say gratuitous, but...
It's not far off.
It's not far off because, you know, a character gets beaten like 5 or 6 times in the face over and over and over and over. Like, I was reminded of one of the most, like, controversial scenes out of Fight Club, where Norton's character just bashes in Jared Leto's face, you know, and just breaks all the rules in one go there, and just breaks the Fight Club rules, if you will.
And I actually like that comparison, because it's exactly the feeling you get. I mean, that scene that you're talking about, not to give any spoilers as to who the character is, but it just, you feel like it's not going to end. That is, it's consistently violent, it's constant, it's almost endless. It's vicious.
When it is to the face as well, I mean, it obviously hits us a little bit more and gets more bloody and bloody as the shot progresses and what have you. Really well done, really, really powerful. It really kind of ends on him, I'll keep it vague, going against higher ups, you know, the government, which is risky, but he's doing, maybe in his frail state, maybe not, what's right. I mean, the movie ends quite shockingly with Kim Do-han doing a thing that will land him in a whole heap of trouble, you know. I'll keep it vague. And it kind of ends right there. It's a cliffhanger ending, which means, you know, those who like two seeing it in the cinema, like, no, I want to see it now. Oh, wait another year, asshole. God damn it.
I think that's wonderful. And from a, you know, a TV watching point of view, as you watch the end of two, you're just doing that just one more episode thing. Because you know number three is going to start in exactly the same place, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's like a scene after. No, barely any credits. Like, in the movie, pay attention. You know, we're 100 miles per hour kind of thing here. We're not leading you up to what happened. You got to know what happened, because we're driving this bitch. So, I mean, I like it. As I said, three I have my issues with, but I like it as a continuation. It's quite exciting, and it has some compelling character in there. And, I mean, if you liked one, there's no reason not to explore two and three. But obviously, two is, in my eyes, stronger out of the between two and three. But it's this one meshes up almost to one. It has one, I think, is stronger just because it was so new. Everything was new. Here, a lot of things are familiar, which is not a criticism. It just is. And I suppose that means the impact isn't as great. It's just a continuation, you know.
I agree again, but for me, it's the extra little bits. I know you're not as much into the whole female thing, but if that hadn't been...
What do you say? What do you mean by that? Don't make me come up as bad, sir.
That came out... You know, Ken watches porn. It's okay. Everything's good.
With men and women.
Well, there you go. That came out completely wrong, but you know what I mean. Just from my point of view.
I don't know as much about depiction of women in Korean cinema. Let's just say that. Was that what you meant?
That's exactly what I meant. But from my point of view, if two had been a similar or more violent version of one, I'd have been really disappointed, because I was looking for what I felt was the second part of a Korean film. And though that may give whoever issues, and certainly I agree three's not as good as either one or two, but two for me almost made one better than one was on its own.
As for availability, parts 2 and 3 are not, at the time anyway, as opposed to 1, on the Korean Film Archive YouTube channel. And the trilogy DVD box set that was out there, and it featured commentaries and interviews, commentaries by InQuantech on all movies, that's out of print. So we had to settle for downloads at this point. For what it's worth, I mean, they ripped the transfers from the DVDs. They did a good job remastering these films. They look really strong and
they
vibrant.
They really do, yeah.
And I think the Korean Film Archive YouTube version, it doesn't look as stellar and is possibly not from the same DVD source. I think if you got the DVD of one, I think that will look a little bit better, a little bit more colorful. But don't quote me on that. It's just a gut feeling I have about because the box set was, you know, it's put out, you know, 1, 2, 3 were together. So I'm thinking like the quality is probably similar throughout the movie. And the source material is not, I don't think one's source material was lying there rotting in chicken poo or anything. I think these were all stored probably equally well.
And I think if nothing else, you know, you've got a download, you've got a decent rip. If you watch it on Kofa, they've got it compressed to a point where anybody with any sort of internet connection can get it. So it's just going to be less than it would be. And, you know, that doesn't detract from the film, but I would like to see one as a remastered, fully perfect, and in as good quality as 2 and 3 anyway.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I don't think they probably did subtitle the main feature. I don't think they went to the extent of subtitling the extra material on the Korean trilogy box set. But if you can't find it, it's probably worth picking up just to have it there. Because the attention to extras for Korean DVDs has obviously been quite great. Maybe too great. They put a commentary and behind the scenes on everything, and I don't think every director can speak well about movies. I think that's just a solid fact. I'm hoping InQuantech is a good speaker.
He is. He's very self-effacing. He's very talkative. He's very informed. He's very open about what he does, why he does it. Like you said, virtually no Korean DVDs have subtitles on any of the extras, which for non-Korean speaking people is a little bit, oh, because, you know, if you could read the subtitles, you could go and buy everything. But they're still worth having it if you've even got a little bit of knowledge in Korean, because they're just, the extras just blow me away, and it's why I still buy Korean DVDs to this day.
Yeah, definitely. It's they do produce some good stuff. I remember, minor tangent, I have the UK DVD of Save the Green Planet, so we did get subtitled extras on that one, and it's just amusing to hear the director and Shi Ha-kyun just snickering at their own movie, like, this is silly. And it's kind of charming that they're not taking that seriously at all.
Yeah, very
and
much
it's
so.
Kind of infectious. For once, it is infectious, because I hate those kind of commentaries where they just, like, laugh the way through it. I always want, just like the podcasts, a mix of info and possibly fun. I mean, I'm not providing the fun, but hopefully someone else will do that. But there we are. Let's take a short musical break and we'll talk the General Sun 3 after that, so sit tight. Welcome back, and we conclude this bonus episode with the look at the final part in the trilogy of The General's Son 3 from 1992. It's kind of, he's rarely mentioned, his father. There's a scene in 2 where he finds out his father has passed away, but not like the day before, like years before. Mm. Because Kim Do-han apparently knew little of his father. Which is, it's what those scenes kind of hinted at, that he knew little of his father. Which is kind of interesting, but because they question Kim Do-han's kind of integrity and loyalty, and they compare him to his father, that he's not as, his characteristics are not strong, as strong as his father was. But hey, that's just me being amused by the name, that it's not like Kim Do-han Gangster 3, it's The General Son. It's a very, very like, curious title. Interesting, though. But anyway, plot and some background from modernkoreancinema.com. And I guess the background is first here. So the final installment of In Quantex, the General's Son trilogy, was not particularly well received upon its release in 1992 in Korea. Unlike the previous two installments, the General's Son was not the year's highest grossing film. That honor went instead to Marriage Story, the, quote, planned feature, which is credited in part with the entry of the so-called Cha-Bol aspect of Korean cinema, and that is explained as Korean conglomerates financing movies. And Marriage Story was, I think they mentioned in the article that Samsung has something to do with Marriage Story. And that modernized kind of the cinema and paved the way for more technically superior Korean cinema of today. As Paul kind of hinted at with his noise, that it's not necessarily a super good thing, that this Cha-Bol, if you will.
Very much, from my point of view, it's what grinds my gears on a daily basis. You know, I'm a huge fan of independent cinema. I'm a huge fan of smaller films. And these conglomerates, just this focus on blockbusters, on trying to dupe America and copy America, it's just taking Korean cinema away from being Korean cinema. And to my mind, it's not a good thing. I mean, you, very short rant, but if you check last month, the two biggest films ever in Korean cinema history, Admiral Wright, Roaring Currents, and The Pirates, they broke all box office records. Everybody, all the companies, Samsung, et cetera, are going, wow, Korean cinema is going through the roof, best ever takings. What they don't mention is that those were the only two films that were screening at the time. Everything else was U.S.
Boy, are we great. Like, we're great. Like, no context or perspective whatsoever. Like,
exactly, you know, and it's just that whole, here's a huge blockbuster. It's done really well because there's nothing else on. Therefore, let's make more blockbusters and let's ignore all the smaller players. And let's face it, you know, the smaller players, at one point, Im Kwon-taek was a small player. At one point, he was tiny compared to Kim Ki-young. And because he was given the chance to do what he does, he became the greatest Korean director that ever lived, that has ever lived, that lives now.
It's a global problem, really. I mean,
I remember.
Me and Coffin John discussed it on a recent Japanophile. That it's the same there. That the money people wants to play it safe because there's money to be made. Money. It's a money making machine, and that kind of, you know, squashes creativity. And I see it in America as well. I mean, so I'm not hugely into the big stuff. I like to see the more sincere, real stuff, and you have to turn to indie cinema. To find the stuff that affects me anyway, personally. Again, I'm not looking down on any viewer who likes their Transformers or what have you. I personally don't. I like something that hits me in another way, not in this bombastic way, if you will.
Totally.
You know, having said that, have you seen Marriage Story? Is it anything? Any good?
It's very watchable. I have to be honest, it's very watchable. That's really all I've got to say about it. You're not going to wake in the middle of the night and think, wow! but you're not going to be bored either. It's a decent little throwaway movie.
To continue on the slight background here, Im Kwon-taek stopped making actioners after this, but he wasn't absent from the top of the charts for long, as his masterful, as Paul has confirmed, Sopyeonje was released the next year in 1993 and became the first Korean film to cross the 1 million admissions mark in Seoul, even though the Korean market share of the box office fell to a record low of 15.9% in 1993. It still crossed that million admissions, and that wasn't this, I gather, this bombastic commercial everybody wants to see, Sopyeonje. It just was this real film that everybody went to see anyway.
Totally. One of my favorite, possibly my all-time favorite Im Kwon-taek movie. And I had an argument about it last night. And I won.
It's my favorite. No, it's my favorite.
No, it's a phenomenal film. And if you haven't seen it, go see it, because it's so understated, it will blow your mind completely. So anybody listening to this, if it's on Kofa, it's free. Go watch it. It's amazing film. If you're not an Im Kwon-taek fan, if you've never seen him, go watch it, because as soon as you watch that, you're going to watch the General Sun one, you're going to watch two, you're going to watch three, and then you're going to search out every other In Contact film you can find. And since there are 102 of them, you're going to be busy for a while.
There it is. So at the start of the General Sun 3, Kim Do-han is not released from jail, as in part 2, but he is in exile, and his gang has been dispersed. The Japanese now control the district, and Kim leads a life wandering from town to town, making connections and enemies along the way. And the first half of the film sees him on the road as he meets characters from previous entries in the franchise and makes some new lady friends, while the back half of the narrative focuses on his return to Mappo Gu and leads up to the final and long-awaited showdown with the local Yakuza gang. So my first shot opinion, it's in my opinion the weakest of the three, but I also kind of see it as one movie together with two, as I've stated before, considering three picks up right after two ended. I'm not sure how that statement, if the subsequent statements are fair, but regardless, I'll say them anyway. It kind of fails to enhance much of Do-han's character, and the added romance in this one doesn't really affect me personally, but it doesn't sink the idea of this portrait of the character as a whole. I'm watching this for the gangster warfare kind of only. I realized I was after a while, but that is pretty solid, because the action and the conflict escalates quite neatly. So, I mean, if I were to see it as 1, 2, and 3, I guess, therefore, the latter half of that big, long movie would be the weaker part compared to the first half. So that's my short, semi-confusing opinion. But there we go. What is your take in short? You've established it before, but still say what you like in terms of your short opinion.
I agree with you 90% and disagree 10%. And disagree is the wrong word, because I agree with everything you said. It is the weakest. It doesn't enhance the character. The fight scenes aren't, to my mind, as explosive or as important as the second one, even though they're heading towards a final showdown.
Do you think we're getting used to them by now? Because they're not bad. I don't think the fight scenes are really bad, but it's just like you're not blown away by the technical excellence of them, but they're by no means like a kind of, oh, here we go again. I was never bored by personally.
No, me neither, but I certainly wasn't. Certainly in 2, there were some fight scenes that were so explosive, so quick, so done, that I almost sat up in my seat. That didn't happen with me with 3. Mm-hmm. In terms of overall story, I do see it as the concluding part of 2. So you can look at it as a very long film. So you almost ease off a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, I tend to agree the more I think about it. It is the longest, though, which was only a worrying thought once I finished it, because I didn't like it as much. Like, hey, why did this need to be the longest? It's 110 minutes, which is not long for a Korean movie, but they've increased ever so slightly in running time as the series gone along. And it really ends well, you know, too. It ends on this cliffhanger that we think he has killed a high-ranking authority person. As a matter of fact, it turns out he hasn't. He's really messed this guy up, you know. I will be vague. And also, this time you really need part 2, as we said, because you can't just go into this one and then go back to 1 and then 2, because you'll be confused why all of a sudden it picks up in the middle of a scene, you know, opening credits, and then you're in the middle of a scene. There's no lead up to, and this happened, you know. In Contact, it expects the cinema audiences to go into this one with 2 in mind, and if they don't, they're kind of fucked.
But I mean, 1 and 2 were so successful anyway that I think his take on 3 was different for a load of reasons. I think he knew how successful the other ones had been. He was concluding the story for that audience. Mm-hmm. And you know, at some point I'm going to mention women again. Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with women.
Yeah. Let's underline that. We watch porn. the whole thing about 3, I know it didn't affect you as much, and it didn't affect me as much. I preferred the female liaisons, if you like, in number 2. But I think this was specifically aimed at a Korean audience. A little bit later, I'll tell you why.
You kind of forget that sometimes as a viewer outside of all this, that sometimes your dislike might be due to you not being a local viewer, that it's not tailored for you exactly. So sometimes you got to reel in your criticism, possibly.
A little bit.
When it is seems local. I mean, if it's an action scene that is not shot well, that is a global thing. That is not a Korean thing. That is not a Hong Kong thing necessarily. That you can't criticize if you don't like it. But sometimes you need to have that perspective too. And the female interest in this one, the female singer of Jang, who is, I believe she's the one, pardon me if my memory is shot, she's the one that he meets fairly early in the movie. She's working off a debt. And later in the movie, she becomes a star and their connection remains. That is the connection that I didn't connect to. But having said that, whatever her name is, pardon me if I don't know it, what a luminous looking actress. She looks doesn't look like a Gong Li, but her impression to me was of, wow, I kind of get the same impression watching Gong Li, like, she just bursts through the screen with her. She looks like a movie star. She really looks like a movie star.
And can I just say that today, she looks as much a movie star as she did then.
A bit of a name check, if you can.
Her name, the actress's name, is Oh Yun-soo. And she did, you know, General Sun and a few other things in the 90s, Piano in Winter, trying to think, Rules of the Game, I think she was in. And then she moved to TV, and she did an awful lot of TV through the years, as many older or aging actresses do. Her most well-known thing was the TV remake of Bad Guy, which was originally Kim Ki-duk's.
Oh, right. The movie where at least the main character never speaks, right?
Yeah, that's him. They did a
How can you do a TV remake of that? Wasn't that quite raunchy and quite controversial, that movie?
Yeah, well, totally. But if TV, they, you know, they're a well placed this, that, and the other,
right?
To cover up your whatevers. And her most famous thing, everybody who's ever watched a Korean drama has heard of Iris. They even made a movie out of it. She was in the sequel, Iris 2, which was, I guess, what, 2013? Yeah, it would have been last year. She's done all that TV, but again, last year she returned to films in a film called Southbound, which is a great, lovely, lovely little independent film. And she's got short hair now, but she's as luminously gorgeous at the age of whatever, 40, 43, as she was when she was in General Sun 3.
Beginning of a career, therefore, being this movie, or maybe her first movie, this one?
This was, I think, from vague recollection, I think it was her second movie, might even have been her third. I should really have all the information in front of me, but I don't.
Seemingly, she speaks both Japanese and Korean in this one. If she learned it for the movie, seems like a good job. If they dubbed her, what a good job. Because it looked like her.
I assume it was her because you can mostly tell if it's dubbed, can't you?
I assume so. I mean, even a great industry isn't, you know, apt at concealing it, especially in Asia. They're not really apt at, even for big budget movies, to conceal it, because they don't make a fuss about it. Because if a character speaks Korean, and if I said she learned Korean for the role, obviously she is Korean, but if a character speaks another language, it just, you can't dub it like a match mouth movements superbly well, like they do in Hollywood. It would have been noticeable, I think. So I don't know Japanese, but it looked very natural. It sounded very natural. And not this like someone slowly trying to get it phonetically or anything. So that happens during Kim Do-han's, you know, exile, and it's amusing that he has to downgrade his conditions, you know, having been this gangster who's living well, not in a big mansion or anything, but living well. And here he has to be content in living in this inn for a while. You know, he's even has to rely on other people's money to even stay there. He's waiting for another gangster boss to kind of bail him out, you know. So he's kind of cocky too. I mean, it's the point, I think, where viewers can start to dislike Kim Do-han, because he comes in there and lies down in the bed in the room, and the boy says, well, $10 in advance. I have no money. I'm just waiting for a guy. And he said, that's where you know, in Quantech is really messing with us, that we are starting to dislike his behavior a little bit here. And intentional, of course, but it's a risk to, like, downgrade his characteristics even to something worse. You know what I mean? Or what's your take on that? Do you think he becomes unlikable for a while?
I totally agree with you, yeah. Certainly, maybe not unlikable, but certainly not as liked from my point of view. But I think that is deliberate. I think, you know, M. Quantech saying he is human. You're not going to love him all the time. He may be, you know, the righteous fighter, but if you'd have him as the perfect fighter and the perfect, you know, loved by everybody all the time thing, by this stage, I'd have got just a little bit too much. So almost eases it off for me a little bit.
Yeah, he's still young. I mean, he's young, and therefore carelessness is not unexpected. And careless he is. Oh boy, is he ever. Because it almost seems like he's so desperate to get a little bit of money. So he goes into, even against this prior friend or prior connection's wishes, the gangster boss of this area, he tries to make an opium deal and fails at it miserably. And he gets jumped by the Chinese trying to sell opium with a friend. And he's really, you know, far removed from his gang, and obviously far removed from making sound decisions at this point, which makes him human, obviously. But that's what I'm quite fond of also, that can he rebound from this, you know? And so certainly the gang is in shambles, so can they rebound from this? And that's one of the main dramatic drives, I suppose. I think that friend is possibly, pardon me if my memory is vague, but certainly, the character of Dong-hae Kim, that relationship is still here, you know, and they need to, you know, heal their relationship, and he needs to, I suppose, seek, it's that age-old redemption story, I suppose, for Dong-hae Kim, after having been, and still to a degree, being this Japanese puppet, if you will. That is still an interesting part of it.
Very much, and in terms of the aimed at Korean people, I guess, there are lots of little things, including that sort of constantly make me think I'm watching this as someone who's looking at Korean cinema from an outside perspective, because that whole redemption, when you think of when this was set, you know, the number of Koreans, Korea was overrun by the Japanese. It was, you know, they tried to stop them using the language. They only had their small little territory, blah, 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 blah. And the number of people who had to constantly interact and, you know, trade, whatever else, with the Japanese. This is almost Im Kwon-taek in hindsight saying, you know, just because they were involved with the Japanese doesn't mean they can't have redemption. Koreans in general can have redemption.
And by this point, too, they're in Manchuria, too, which is also, you know, Japanese territory by that point.
Totally. And I love the fact that just before they go there, when they're in the other little Korean community, one of the Koreans actually says the Japanese aren't too bad to us here. They treat us better than the Chinese. To me, that again just will underline to every Korean that, yeah, you know, Japanese, Korean, Chinese, it's all separate, and we were treated better than the Chinese, and that's a big thing from my point of view.
Definitely something that he does well in underlining clearly, but not hugely, like, listen up, I'm saying stuff now. You know, and even, I noticed this on a technical level, Im Kwon-taek is not afraid to do very unintrusive jump cuts, because a lot of time passes through one cut to another sometimes. Yeah. You know, at one point, Kim Do-han has been, and Dong-hae Kim, I believe, hugely beaten up by the Chinese. And one cut later, essentially, after you've seen them in bandage, they're all right. And Im Kwon-taek doesn't do a, create a whole lot of fuss about weeks having passed or months having passed. And I think that is quite brave, because it could have been like very, where's the scars, man? There should be all bloodied and have bandage on there. You know, what's going on? But he's clearly comfortable in and knows his audience will keep up with that. If they don't know it by the time the cut happens, a few seconds later, it will probably, time has passed. So what?
And that's a, you know, even for an established director, that's a brave move. But it's away with it.
It happens every now and again, too, throughout the trilogy. It's not his trademark, stylish trademark or anything, but it definitely happens throughout. And I admire that. And throughout this movie as well, you know, all three movies, really, it does its thing rather quiet. But the whole arc, if you will, you have to, at least I did, when I watched Freed and when I realized I wasn't as much into it, you have to, I think, put yourself in the mindset that it's all one, and it's an engaging overall arc. Therefore, I liked it from the get-go, and I like two, and while I find this weaker, I've not grown to dislike the arc, like the entire story and the story of Kim Do-han and his appearance overall. So it's, I think that was important for me to kind of just balance myself a little bit. Like, it's not disappointing, really. It's just not as good. I'm not as much into it on a character level, but I'm not really disappointed by the gangster warfare here, because the action element is still strong. The fist brawls and the kicking. I mean, kicking, one of his closest henchmen that you see, not the big guy, but one of the younger guys, is an amazing kicker too. You know, he's surrounding himself, you know, with actors and action actors that are, and performers that are really, really good at that. Because the fighting style is often involving that. You know, even if it's tight brawls in one room and what have you, there's some amazing kicking and plentiful power here. And I think I was still impressed, very much impressed by that.
Just exactly the same thing. There's one scene in particular that sticks in my head from Three, where Kim Do-han's actually in a small space fighting, and he's got a coat on, and the whole acrobatics within that tiny space is absolutely phenomenal. It blows my mind. Overall, Three's fight scenes, yeah, I've been there, seen it, but there's still things that just make you go, wow, look at the choreography of that. Look at the precision of that. It's stunning.
Also because you very much know this, that Korean action cinema, that's not, certainly in the 90s anyway, and certainly not now, it's forte. It's not a challenger to Hong Kong cinema. And it never really has been, unless there were Hong Kong Korean co-productions where Hong Kong stars went to Korea and they worked with Korean crew and what have you. And you had some cool stuff in the 70s and 80s, but that's why it impresses that this is a genuinely good Korean cinema action experience too.
Exactly, which is not as regular a thing as you might think it is.
Yeah, I mean, you have martial arts themed movies, I suppose. What was that? It's not a good description, but there was a big like biopic of a famous fighter sometimes in the 2000s. I remember the limited edition came with a gi, if you will, like something you wear while you're practicing martial arts. But I'm blacking on the name now. But still, can you think of many, you know, post-millennium anyway, movies that were strong Korean dramatic movies and also contenders, action contenders, if you look at martial arts alone?
There are some great martial arts movies. I mean, around the new wave, or the new Korean cinema of 2000 whatever, you'd things like Taekwondo, which was set in a, funnily enough, Taekwondo school, fighting leading to, you know, blah blah blah, same old thing, and it was really well done. One of the still doesn't beat this.
No, for heaven's sake, no. I mean, it's and I guess the guy and the team who did City of Violence and Arahan, but they were more focused on being, not that it's a bad thing, but they were more focused on being action movies rather than dramas with action elements. Huge thumbs up, and really something I did not expect. But I did not know of its action beats or drive. I only know Kim Do-han was a fighter. But so it was a very much a pleasant surprise. And I suppose a drive here is a violent drive, but it also what InQuantech never catches me engaging in as much as he seems to want anyway, is that extended relationship between the Kim Do-han and Jang Eun-si, or Eun-si Jang, the singer. I saw what he was doing, but I and her, what she meant to him and kind of what she sacrificed for Kim Do-han, it's not just his fling. And he's certainly consumed by her to the point where he forgets a gang meeting, a really important gang meeting that he's even reminded of. Don't forget the meeting! While he rides away in the train. But still, that seems like such a key element, and I couldn't find an emotional attachment as such. But hearing me talk about it, listeners, and you certainly, Paul, I don't hate it. But it's in an element that no Kim Contact wanted something with that I couldn't latch onto, really.
And here we go with my assumptions again. This was set mid-occupation, you know, Kim Do-han, blah, 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 blah. At that point, if you think or look back at women in Korea, the whole thing for them was aim for marriage from the age of 14. Once you get married, your life is serving your husband. You sacrifice everything. You willingly give up everything. I agree that this relationship isn't as strong as the one in two, but there are a couple of things that Eun-sil, the singer character, says that scream to me that this is 1993, I think it was, Matt?
Released 93 anyway. Or 92, by the way, pardon me. I was totally wrong. So
this is about a time way in the past, but the woman in it actually speaks to women of the 90s in Korea. There are two lines that character says that actually, again, made me actually sit up in my chair. She at one point says she doesn't want to marry because she still has things she wants to do. And for a woman in the 30s or 40s, that would have been an unthinkable thing to say, because the Korean focus was you're a woman, you get married, your life is your husband and your family. For a woman to say, I still have things to do, would have been unacceptable. She would have been alienated. She wouldn't have had anything from anybody. And because this was done in the 90s, as women were starting to realize that they were individuals and realize they had their own wants and needs, that statement of, I don't want to get married because I have still things to do, and she later says, I don't want to sacrifice everything for a man. Same thing. I can imagine the women in the audience actually watching it and just sinking their teeth straight into believing everything that woman said, because she spoke to them. She's not speaking to us. She's weaker from our point of view. But to women of the 90s in Korea who were watching this in cinemas, she was them. And that's what I think that relationship's all about. It's a modern woman in a historical drama.
And I actually can take, you know, lack of attachment to that as a sign of this is something I can't pick up on it properly, you know what I mean? And I'm not trying to, like, backpedal or anything. But you're very right. Those lines are very, very important, but I don't have that insight into Korea of the time and Korean cinema. So I'll happily, you know, say that there's a lot of stuff here that I'm not yet apt at possibly picking up, you know. And that, because that is super interesting, valid, and poignant too. And the more I think of it, yeah, you would expect the time it was set in for them to marry, like, off the bat.
Totally, totally. And I mean, the whole thing about me talking to InQuantech and his films constantly referring to the strength of women and how women are not just objects, how women have rights, how women have a right to feminism, is so constant. As I say, watch Sopyeonje, watch the Taibak Mountains, you know, watch Surrogate Mother, stuff from before and after The General's Son. It just screams that he wouldn't let her be just a historical woman. He has to say something about femininity in modern day Korea as it was when this film was released, and that's why it's stuck with me. But then again, as I say, I'm just overtly obsessed with depictions of Korean women in cinema and how they've changed over the years, so I'm going to pick up on stuff that I shouldn't pick up on because I'm...
I think it's there. I definitely think it's there. At least having seen this and listening to you, I think that that's definitely there and very, very forward-thinking in a society, certainly back then and certainly now, that is still not as equal as it should be. You know, we've come far, but I don't think we've come far enough in terms of...
Totally, and those sorts of themes are still showing up in Korean cinema in, you know, post 2010, 12, 14. So it's still incredibly unequal.
And yeah, it's right about the end of my notes, really. I mean, it ultimately ends, you know, on a big action set piece and finally them, you know, trying to defeat the Hayashi gang. There's some haunting imagery here, by the way. A wonderful scene where the Jonguro gang is walking down the street and through the market on this really deep set, which looks like a studio set, but really well done. And there's a tram running, like a train running through it. And that train, after they pass the railroad lines, that train runs past it. And then you see the Japanese gang enter the frame, you know, and are about to walk down that long, long, long pathway to do some massacring, you know. And it's a really haunting shot because you know they got their blades out, you know, they're not just walking, they're there to massacre anyone who gets in the way. Really haunting shot. That stuck with me on that level. And but having said that, it's doesn't it ends brutally in a primal way, but not as primal as you might think. Kim Do-han still shows he's not turning into this bloodthirsty character necessarily. Blood has been spilt, but he's not bloodthirsty as such. There's still, even in that frantic state, which he's definitely in, because he's taken on a lot of people and blood is shed, he still has that sense of, I don't know, honor or just humanity about him. That's a good friend to have, and certainly it seems like, anyway, because the whole movie is honoring him. Seems like a setup for characteristics that would run through his life in politics. Not that politics are about bloodshed, obviously, but I don't know, a mixture of good natured and forward thinker, and not just this not acting all on impulse, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say, aside from the very, very final scene, which I liked, the culmination disappointed me in a way, and I know it has to be this way to show exactly what you just said, that Kim Do-han's, you know, reserved in some ways, forward thinking. I wanted a different outcome. And out of the whole three films, I think penultimate scene of this disappointed me the most. And that's a personal thing.
But it ends, when it's over, it's over. I can appreciate the movie that's over when it's over. We cut to credits pretty quick. And that's where I realized, like, hey, is there not even going to be a text about Kim Do-han did this and this and this? But no. Im Kwon-taek is not apparently interested in even mentioning he went into politics. Of course, the local audiences knew that pretty much, you know, so he's not playing to the local audience. But it was still kind of surprising to me that he contained it to this only, and that was his choice, and I thoroughly respected that. I was just expecting another thing, foolishly or not, you know, that there's going to be a hint dropped anyway that this was his life past, but nope, in the General Sun 4 or not, you know. And as far as you know, has there been a big Kim Do-han movie since this movie?
Not that I know of. We already spoke about stuff in the 70s and this, that, and the other. I think this...
You wonder why not, though? Because it seems like material many filmmakers want to touch, or they just regard this trilogy as, I'm not touching that. Regardless, even if it didn't touch on the politics, maybe they were just like, I'm not going to be compared to Im Kwon-taek.
Yeah, and that's a fair point. I wouldn't want to fight him, you know, in a corner. I think this is definitive for what it is. I agree that you'd think there would have been something later on about the political career. I'm not aware of anything more about Kim Doohan other than these, or subsequent to these. So I'm assuming that's pretty much it, and everybody thinks it's a done deal, and they're moving on to Korea today.
Let me ask you this: ultimately, do you think these movies are very representative of what In Contact can do, or are they slightly more commercial, slightly more action-oriented and violent, or are they ultimately very In Contact? You know.
Personally, I don't think they're as In Contact as you might want them to be. He started out very commercial, and he moved towards sort of art house and sort of flitted here and there. This, for me, was him going back to something that is essentially commercial. It's an action flick. It's got little pointers here, there, and everywhere that you can pull if you want, but it's a commercial film. And it was after this that he became In Contact, in my opinion. There's some phenomenal films before, but it's his post-career that made him who he is, that when you watch a film, you think, that's In Contact, without even knowing it was directed by him. I don't think you get that with The General Son. I think it's a very well-made commercial film made by a guy who was used to making commercial films.
Right. Well, it's going to be interesting to watch Sopion yet to kind of compare feels, if you will, for me, definitely. Especially since I know it followed on the heels of this one. I don't know if he made a movie in between or not, but certainly it was just around the corner.
It was his next film, and I cannot wait. I know we're connected, you know, on social networks.
I'm not going to tell you what I thought, ever.
You have to. As soon as you watch Sopion Jay, I want you to, you know, post on a wall or whatever, and tell me what you think, because I'll guarantee you won't be able to stop yourself from doing it. It's going to be that different.
I'm certainly going to pursue it, definitely, regardless. And it's free to watch legally as well on Kofa. So that's it. As for availability, same. This was part of a DVD trilogy box set that is unfortunately out of print right now. And it's not available on the Korean Film Archive YouTube channel, The General Sun 3, that is. So, again, we got the download of it that is presumably a rip of the very, very good looking DVD of the movie. So hopefully that'll be repressed at some point, but it seems like some of these are not being repressed. Some of these retrospective kind of box sets that I don't know if the Film Archive actually was involved in creating the box set. I wouldn't be surprised if they were.
As far as I'm aware, they were involved in remastering the whole thing to get it ready and get it released for a thing. But it's the same thing with Korean DVDs in general. When they come out, they've got big limited edition, and then within a space of months, it disappears and it's not reprinted. Getting old Korean DVDs is a nightmare, much more than Chinese or Japanese stuff, and it's another niggle that gets me, because there's a lot of really old stuff that I'd love to go and buy on DVD, but it's all out of print and it's all not being re-released.
And thankfully, some of that got onto Kofa that was on DVD previously, now out of print, and there at least there's a transfer out there on Kofa, albeit not HD or anything, but still, you know, it's out there and what have you, and we certainly have reaped the benefits of that.
And it does have to be said that recently, as we were saying before, they've started to bring a lot of Blu-rays out of older Korean films. I know you sought down Castaway on the Moon and stuff. They're doing that a lot more, so I'm hoping that they're just going to gradually get round, and maybe eventually we'll have a DVD box set for a limited time of the three together. But, you know, we just have to keep checking.
Indeed. Alrighty, so thank you everybody for following us on the entire General Sun journey in this website exclusive bonus episode. As I said, we reviewed the first part in the main episode that's out there on our website and is on iTunes and everywhere, but this is only on our website. So I always enjoy this format, the freedom of it, to offer up something optional, because it's not like the main show is lacking just because we didn't talk of 2 and 3, because the way 1 ends is not a cliffhanger, so it's okay to stop talking about it. Our discussion wasn't it was conclusive, you know, but this format I enjoy very much, and I thank you for being on the entire journey with me, because I couldn't have done it without you, really. I mean, the perspective you bring, Paul, is absolutely marvelous, so I thank you for that.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to hear, you know, and as I was saying to you before we started, you know, rewatching these things, I find things that I didn't notice before that change my perspective on stuff that I'm going to be doing in the future, so it's really great for me as well.
Indeed. Excellent. Well, thank you very much then, everybody, and we are signing off now, and I've been Kenny B, and with me was Hangul Celluloid's Paul Quinso. Say bye, buddy.
See you later, guys.